Welcome to KPTZ's Nature Now, a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of kptz.org.
Hello, this is Debron Kelso, host of this edition of Nature Now for the first week of September. We are very pleased to have part two of our interview with U.S. Forest Service wildlife biologist Betsy Howell for you this week, speaking with us about small carnivore surveys on the Olympic National Forest. And we are equally pleased to have sound engineer extraordinaire Charlie Fleischman here on this side of the mic to help share observations and events. Welcome, Charlie.
Glad to be here, Debron.
But before we get to our main topic, let's first hear the mystery sound of the week. Yes, you're right. It is a bird. But what kind of bird? We'll play it again at the end of the program and tell you what it is.
Our recent rain, along with the noticeably cooler weather, has helped to dampen the four fires that have been burning deep in the wilderness areas of Olympic National Park. All of these fires were started by lightning about 6 weeks ago, and none of them have been actively fought, since they are within wilderness areas and pose no threat to humans. Three of them lie within 25 miles south of Port Angeles, and the fourth about 22 miles northwest of Lake Quinault. Two trails remain closed due to fire activity, the Elwha River Trail from Hayes River Ranger Station south to Chicago Camp, and the Hayden Pass Trail from Dosey Meadows at the east to the junction with the Elwha River Trail at the west.
A few weeks ago, we had a question in from contributor Noreen Parks, who had been noticing a bumper crop of Douglas fir cones and wondered if this might be related to an El Nino year. It turns out that it is. Geneticists working on conifers have known for quite some time that drought stress will cause trees to put much of their energy into cone production. There is a time delay, however. The bumper cone crops that we are seeing right now were triggered by the extremely droughty summer that we had last summer, not this one. Douglas squirrels are busy taking advantage of the cone bounty, snipping off the Douglas fir cones with their papery bracts, but also the heavy clusters of true fir cones. I was hiking up at higher elevations in the silver fir zone last week and noticed the ground littered with clusters of giant freshly cut cones, and was thankful that I hadn't been hiking there when they came down.
Jeff Hammerson reports that bats have been very active feeding around the Katai Lagoon this past week. This would probably be a good time to remind you to be very careful when dealing with bats, as they often carry rabies in our area, even if they do not appear to be sick themselves. The disease can also be transmitted through saliva, so one does not have to be bitten to contract it. Best is to avoid handling bats altogether, but if you need to rescue one that has gotten into your house, please remember to put some gloves on.
Jeff also shared a fascinating photo essay of some carrion beetles and symbiotic mites. The beetles are beautiful, with dramatic orange and black striped backs. And riding piggyback on them were all of these tiny orange mites. Jeff writes, "The beetles and the mites were on a deer mouse carcass. This species of beetle normally buries carcasses, which serve as food for the adult beetles and their larvae. Over 2 days, the beetles moved the mouse over 60 inches, apparently seeking a suitable place to bury it, but the ground was too hard to do so. The mites eat fly eggs and larvae that compete with the beetles for food. The mites get transported to the carcasses by hitchhiking on the beetles." Unquote. Isn't nature something?
And lastly, keep your eyes peeled for those nasty, invasive green crabs. Earlier this week in Westcott Bay, San Juan Island, a team of volunteer monitors caught one, marking the first confirmation of this global invader in Washington's inland waters. European green crab have been stowaways on ships bound for U.S. ports since the 1800s, establishing populations, eating local clams and other shellfish, and causing serious impacts. But up to now, they have only been found on Washington's Pacific coastal estuaries. Nature Now's own Ann Evans focused on this problem in a two-part series this summer. If you missed it, go to our podcast at kptz.org, and to learn how to identify and report these creatures, go to wsg.washington.edu/crabteam.
So last month when we talked with biologist Betsy Howell about the Fisher reintroduction project, we ran out of time. So we're going to finish up with Fishers and then go on to talk about a really cool Pacific Marten project that's starting up on the Olympic National Forest. So we are going to finish up with Fishers now. Betsy was just talking to us about how they are analyzing the DNA from blood and hair samples that the Fishers have left behind. So what can they tell from a DNA sample?
Right. Well, actually, an amazing number of things. So last time we had talked a little bit about the animals who were initially brought to the peninsula and released here. All of them had hair and blood samples taken and DNA profiles created. And now, in 2016, the animals that we're finding at the camera and hair snare stations, if we are able to get good hair samples from them that don't get too wet and don't get degraded, we can tell, once that DNA is analyzed, if they are one of those original founding members brought to the peninsula 6 to 8 years ago by matching what we find now with the profile that was created then. Or if they weren't an original founding member, we are able to tell. Actually, I personally am not, but the people in the lab who study this can match that DNA with the founding members.
That's so amazing, isn't it?
It's quite astonishing. And so, for example, a couple of years ago, we had two camera stations and hair snares set up around Lake Cushman in two different watersheds. And we got Fishers at the camera. We got good hair collected. It was sent off to the lab for analysis and determined that one of the Fishers was a female. She was a new animal, but her parents had been founders. They had been released in the Elwha in 2008. They were part of the first group of animals to come down. And then the second animal that was found that winter turned out to be that particular female's daughter. So she was the first second generation Fisher born.
Oh, how cool.
So this is great evidence of a population that's starting to sustain itself.
Oh, that's great. So there are some summary reports which people can read, these great stories, right?
There are, yeah. I'd encourage anybody who's interested to go to the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife Fisher website. The annual summary reports are posted there, and in the appendices of each one are these sort of stories of the animals where we've gotten good DNA samples from and we're able to figure out their parentage and then kind of create a story around where they were found on the cameras, where their parents moved when the telemetry was all still being monitored. Of course, I'm kind of a biased person, but it's great reading.
Yeah, no, I would like to read it too. So do we know how many Fishers are out there now?
Well, we don't have an exact number, unfortunately, and that's actually a question I get asked a fair bit. The original four measurements of success that we talked about last time for the project, which are determining if Fishers are establishing home ranges, if they're moving and finding each other, if they're surviving, and if they're reproducing, none of those really involve a number, a goal, say, of like we want to reach 200 Fishers on the peninsula or something like that, because it would be extremely difficult to ever be able to know that. The landscape is too difficult and the animals just move a lot. So the indicators to answer positively that Fishers are moving around the landscape, surviving, establishing home ranges, and reproducing, all of those seem to be being met. And so that bodes well for the Fisher population for sure.
Certainly hope so. So how long will the monitoring go on?
Well, this 2016 survey season will be the last year for this particular effort of Fisher monitoring. So far, it's been a really good season. During the spring surveys, we got Fishers coming into stations in 9 of the 27 survey areas, which is about a third.
Yeah, well, that's great. I'm surprised it's that high.
That's the highest it's ever been. So that makes everyone really happy. And these stations, I think all of them also had hair. So there should be some DNA results coming back from those as well. In terms of after the field work ends this year, It'll take another year to finish all the data entry, get all the DNA results back, write up the reports, and publish those findings. So that'll take a fair bit of work. But there will be future Fisher work. In fact, the Macaw tribe has obtained funding to continue Fisher surveys on their lands, and they really do want to get a population estimate, which I think might be a lot more possible on a smaller area of land, kind of opposed to the whole peninsula. But for the park and forest and other areas, we might be able to start some kind of lower intensity carnivore inventory in the next couple of years, and then also perhaps in another 5 to 6 years start an effort like we have going now, which would be great to kind of assess things after some time has gone by.
Uh-huh. Well, at that time, we hope that we'll all be seeing more fishers out there. That would be so exciting. So anyway, let's move on to the other small carnivore project that's happening now more recently on the peninsula. You've been working with Pacific Marten, right?
Right, we have. So the Pacific Martens are the smaller cousins of the fisher. They're actually a fair bit smaller. They're about only 1 to 2 pounds, kind of squirrel-sized, so they're not particularly large, but they eat similar prey. They live in similar habitats. Fishers and martens have evolved together, and they've also historically both been subjected to the same kinds of trapping pressures. So the camera surveys that were done in the 1990s and early 2000s that did not document fishers in any part of Washington did document martens in the Cascades, though they did not in the Olympic Peninsula. But because they were found in the Cascades, they sort of weren't as immediate of a conservation concern as opposed to fishers that were found nowhere.
Seems strange, doesn't it, that they would be doing really well in the Cascades and be completely gone or almost completely gone from the Olympics.
Right, right. Yeah, it has been a really big question. Why do martens still seem to be thriving in the Cascades, but we just haven't been able to find them with any great frequency or any great numbers in the Olympics? And this even became more of a question when in June of 2015, two photos of martens did turn up on the peninsula.
Oh, well, that's really good news. So where were those photos taken?
One was from almost the summit of Mount Cruiser, which is just north of Lake Cushman on the forest, and the other one was in the Upper Ho near Mount Olympus in the National Park. And that was actually from a remote camera out for Fisher surveys. And the other one was taken by a rock climber who happened to stop, and a martin kind of poked its nose out of the rocks. But up until 2015, we'd only had 3 verifiable records of martens on the National Forest or National Park, and those were from 1988, 1990, and then 2008, when a dead juvenile was found on the Mount Rose Trail just north of Lake Cushman. But between 2008 and 2015, we've just had dozens and dozens of cameras out, and we had not been able to get any martens on any of those cameras. So when these two pictures showed up last year, we were really encouraged and began to think more about a more concerted effort to look for martens in addition to the fisher work.
Uh-huh. So what's involved in this effort?
Well, it's, you know, because the animals are really similar, of course, the methods are also very similar with the remote cameras, to some extent with the hair snare boxes as well. But in light of last summer's photos, we knew we wanted to put the cameras up at much higher elevations than what some of the fisher cameras, where they were being placed. But oddly enough, we also decided to look at coastal habitats as well. This might seem kind of strange.
It does seem strange. I don't imagine them there at all.
Though actually, historically, there are reports from trappers of them being pretty plentiful in some lowland swampy areas. But additionally, more recently, in Oregon, some inventory efforts have shown them to be living within sight of the Pacific Ocean. So they've been finding martens west of Highway 101 in Oregon, living under the salal and shore pine coastal vegetation. So since Olympic Park's coastal strip hadn't been thoroughly surveyed in some years, we decided to do this kind of two-pronged approach, which was to do a winter effort in the coastal strip, and then a summer effort in the high elevations when we could actually get to those areas. So in the winter, the crew set up 108 cameras from Claylock to Ozette. Part of the reason we did that in the winter, too, is just to avoid all the raccoon and bear problems, because those animals would definitely come into the cameras. While we didn't get any martens, almost half of those cameras did pick up fishers.
Wow.
So that was pretty high rate compared to some of our areas where we've been trying to get fishers. So, and we got some DNA from those, and one of those fishers turned out to be another second-generation animal. So,
oh, cool.
So that was exciting, even if we didn't get any martens.
So do you know if marten and fisher actively compete with each other? Is there any chance that once a fisher is detected, that this then decreases the chances that you'd get marten in the same location?
Well, I think martens and fishers have certainly evolved together and learned how to exploit their own little niches. I don't know for sure that if a fisher was detected, it would reduce the chances of getting a marten, but I also think that a smart marten will avoid crossing paths too often with a fisher, because the fishers will certainly kill them. They're much bigger, and it's all about competition for resources, and they eat some of the same things. So that could have an influence.
But back to martens. So no martens were detected on the cameras?
Not during the winter effort, no. But as always with these wildlife surveys, if you get no detections, you can't say that they're not there, because there could be any number of reasons why you're not finding them. But at the same time, we're definitely not able to confirm presence. So after finishing those winter surveys, in March, we started planning for the summer ones, which are taking place right now.
And have these cameras picked up any martens yet?
Well, as of right now, we don't really know. The 85 cameras that we have out have just now been installed. So some of them have been checked once just to make sure they're working okay. We haven't confirmed any martens during those checks, but they're also going to be up a number of weeks. So, of course, we're hopeful. And the cameras are mostly on the east side from east side of the forest and park from Lake Cushman, Mount Rose, Mount Eleanor area, north to Lake Constance. And then there are also 20 stations in the Upper Ho around Mount Olympus. So the highest elevations the crew could get to safely around Timberline or just above or just below. Yeah, again, because they're just kind of so inaccessible, they're not getting regular checks like we normally do. But several have been checked. They're working well. They'll be out for about 60 days or maybe a little bit less. And if we do get a marten on any one of them, then a hair collection box hair snare device will be put out, and hopefully we'll get some DNA information as well.
What if no martens are detected in these areas either?
Well, obviously we're all hoping to find martens in these locations, because they're kind of our best estimates of where they remain on the peninsula. But if we don't get any, we'll have to return to the drawing board, basically, and figure out what to do next. However, the work will still be valuable, because there will be a lot of good information on other species, including different carnivores that come into the cameras. And from the first round of checks, we have gotten a number of weasels, some bobcat. So all of the photographs will end up being tagged and organized, and we'll do some analysis on presence and distribution of all the species. So in terms of the martens, though, if we get skunked, so to speak, then we'll have to figure out the next.
If they seem to be gone from the peninsula, would it be possible to reintroduce them, similar to fishers?
Well, at this time, I don't think anyone would really want to conclude martens aren't here, even if we don't find any with this year's survey effort, just because, obviously, last summer's photos show that they are here, though they could be in really low densities, and they just could be in extremely difficult places to find them. So it is a good question, because it comes up, should we reintroduce them like we did with the fisher? And especially since there actually do seem to be a good number of martens in the Cascades, but bringing animals in from over there as a part of a reintroduction project could be really premature if there are animals here and if they're sustaining themselves, because it just could make a big tangle of the genetics.
Yeah, we think we're doing a good thing and instead we're making a big mess the way human beings so often do, intending to do good.
Yeah, it's certainly possible. So, and also at the same time right now that we're doing all this field work, there's also some work going on with genetics of martens from the peninsula, mostly historical museum specimens that they've taken some DNA from, as well as the Mount Rose juvenile that was found in 2008, and just looking at what the genetic makeup is for these animals compared to the Cascades in Washington and Oregon and the coastal martens in Oregon. And
it could be a separate subspecies. And
so it'll be good to, yeah, kind of wait and see what the results of that looks like and see what we get for these surveys. And if we don't get any animals, we'll just think of something to do for the next step.
Uh-huh. Well, thanks so much for joining us again, Betsy. We've run out of time again. And we'll look forward to having you back next year to tell us what the results from this year's surveys have been, and hopefully with news that martens have been found.
Well, I will look forward to that, and I hope I have that kind of news to share.
Oh, I know, me too. Thanks again.
Thank you.
We only have one upcoming natural history event to tell you about, but it's a dandy. Come join the Jefferson Land Trust for their biggest fundraising event of the year, Rainfest Reimagined. It takes place at the Finn River Orchard next Thursday evening, September 15th. But tickets are going fast, so register today at saveland.org.
And here's our mystery sound again. It's a spotted sandpiper, and we've played both its song and call for you. I chose it because our time with this beautiful shorebird is near its end. They are one of our most common and widespread summer residents, but it is rare to find them in our region in the wintertime. In summer, they are easy to distinguish, with their dark spotted breast on a white background and reddish bill, their constant teetering motion, and clear, high-pitched whistles. In winter plumage, they are much more drab, losing their spots and bright bill. They are unusual for shorebirds in that they are highly territorial at all seasons, so they do not form the huge flocks that shorebirds are often known for. They are also unusual in that it is the female that is the territory holder, staking it out and defending it, and she will often mate with more than one male. The female lays 4 eggs and then leaves the male to incubate them while she finds another mate. In this way, she may breed with up to 4 males, each of which will raise a clutch. The female would then often raise a final clutch herself. What a life, eh? And that's it for KPTZ's Nature Now for the first week of September. Thanks very much for joining me, Charlie, and to all of you for listening. Remember, if you missed any of our program or want to listen again, this program will be rebroadcast at 5 p.m. on Thursday, 11:30 on Saturday, and available as a podcast in a week or so at kptz.org. As always,
happy trails.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Today's closing music is Crazy, Believe It or Not, performed by Martin Fisher.